PromoHomo.tv begins right now.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the show. This is PromoHomo.tv. I am the host, Nicholas Snow. It is Friday, June 3rd, 2016 at 10 a.m. And coming up on the show, I have Thomas Davis, an HIV/AIDS activist, who's going to be talking about that meeting, that now infamous meeting with Bernie Sanders after this.
PromoHomo.tv begins right now. Simulcast on Blog Talk Radio and Facebook Live, which basically means this is a worldwide television show that you can watch from any internet-connected device and you can call in. How cool is that? This show is made possible with the generous support of Desert AIDS Project, Lulu California Bistro, 849 Restaurant and Lounge, and we're a proud media sponsor of the LGBT Community Center of the Desert, Palm Springs Pride, and numerous other organizations and causes. For more about our sponsors and those we support, visit promohomo.tv. And now, on with the snow. I mean Joe.
And here I am on PromoHomo.tv. And on the phone already, Thomas Davis. Welcome to the show, Thomas.
Hello, good morning. It's nice to be back.
Well, it's nice to have you back. So,
thank you.
Please, for those, what happened when I had you on earlier in the week is I forgot to plug in my phone, which I did again. So I'm glad that I just said that out loud because now I'm plugging in my phone. Because if I don't plug in my phone, I'll lose power in the middle of the broadcast, and then our show will end. Anderson St. James has joined in. Welcome to the show, Anderson. So Thomas, for those who are unaware, let's backtrack a bit and tell me, first of all, there's lots of HIV/AIDS activists in the country, but many of them are active enough that they know each other. So why don't you describe from your perspective how these leading HIV/AIDS activists are in touch with each other? How does that work? What is the system of activism here in the United States as you understand it?
Mm-hmm. Well, for me, I've only been doing this work for 3 years now, so that's actually a very short amount of time considering the epidemic's been here for 35 plus years or so. But from what all my connections and how I've gotten to, I guess, be a part of that network has just been by being involved in different conferences, traveling to all these different places, and then slowly the network, for me at least, has really built on social media because it's a great way for people to share the work that they're doing, to get in touch with people that maybe they haven't necessarily met, but, you know, we all are working for the same cause. And, you know, as I've come to find, it's actually, when it comes to the community that are activists, it's actually a pretty small, it's a pretty connected community.
Well, I agree with you, and I met you at an HIV/AIDS activism conference in San Diego. Conference is evading me. Do you remember?
USCA, the United Conference on AIDS.
Exactly. Exactly, and that's how you and I met, and I'm grateful for that. So there's an association of activists, and we all are doing our own little piece of activism wherever we are. I think, frankly, anybody that speaks about what's important to them is practicing a certain amount of activism if they're trying to impart that belief to someone else. So clearly this is a heated presidential campaign, and activists are looking to advance their agendas with the political parties. And one of the things that happened is Hillary Clinton met with HIV/AIDS activists, and then a meeting ultimately came about with Bernie Sanders, but that was a meeting that almost didn't happen. So would you explain the background of that?
Yes, originally this meeting with Bernie Sanders was actually the thing that happened first, because after Hillary Clinton's little gaffe where she said that Nancy Reagan started the National Conversation on HIV and people were upset about it, she made an apology basically and started to bring up HIV that it would need to be an issue brought to the forefront. So Bernie Sanders issued a plan about it, and you know, HIV activists reached out to him to try to give their input and to make sure that he had really done the work informing him of this. That meeting got rescheduled. Then they had the meeting with Hillary Clinton, and then reached out to the Sanders campaign again. I just said the campaign because they lost contact with them and they weren't hearing back. After the Sanders campaign saw that they met with Hillary Clinton, they then responded and rescheduled the meeting. So, yes, when that happened, that meeting happened here in California about a week and a half ago, a week or two ago. And, yeah, so that's kind of how we made that. Well, I mean, I'm not going to say we, but how those that put this meeting together made that happen.
Okay, and I think another important thing to do to put this in context, by the way, Clifton is watching. He was a guest on the show earlier this week called A Leatherman Exposes Himself. And Clinton, I don't understand Clifton, excuse me, I don't understand your comment. So if you could elaborate. I want to make sure that our viewers and listeners are hearing and seeing this okay. If you have any recommendations or suggestions, please comment below. So one of the things I think is important, Thomas, is that we talk about sort of the rift that exists between a lot of leading HIV AIDS service organizations and another organization, AIDS Healthcare Foundation. From your perspective, is there a rift between AIDS Healthcare Foundation and other leading HIV AIDS service organizations? And if so, how would you describe that rift? I know I've opened a can of worms,
Okay. I'm going to try to be as diplomatic as possible in my answer. Yes.
You don't have to be diplomatic. Speak from your heart. If they want to come on my show, they're welcome. You're an activist.
All right.
Speak as passionately as you would like.
I mean, okay. Well, okay. So, yes, there is a huge risk. And from you know, again, I'm just going to say, you know, I've only been doing this work for 3 years, so I'm just going to share my take on it and just how I for me, it just seems to be that this is a large organization that isn't always on the same page as the rest of the community in certain issues, whether it be around PrEP, whether it be around how they advertise and advocate for, you know, getting tested or disclosure. You know, there are just a lot of things, you know, and then there's a lot of stuff, I guess, financially that I don't really know a whole lot about that I wouldn't be the best person to answer. But overall for me, I guess with me and the big rift with me and the organization is that I just think their approach is really, really questionable, and I question the motivation behind many of the things that they do and say. For me, at first, when I was an early activist and I just started speaking out, they were an organization that reached out to me and wanted me to do a lot of work with them, but their approach and how they were trying to coach me into working with them just did not feel genuine. It didn't feel right. It just kind of felt like they're just trying to get, you know, a young black man to, you know, speak for them. So, you know, just for me, I just, it's always been the integrity, I guess, for me has always been very questionable. And it's not to say that they don't do great work. Like, they are, you know, the largest HIV-serving organization in the world. You know, so, I mean, I guess it doesn't necessarily surprise me that an organization that, you know, that sustains off of treating people with HIV would be so against something that is so effective at preventing it, I guess. You know, that makes sense in retrospect. But, with me, it's been that they seem to be not in line with the rest of the community on several issues.
Okay, well, that was awfully diplomatic. we are, okay, so we had a brief pause in our video stream, but it came back. So that was very diplomatic. But one of the things that I guess I would like to speak about more specifically regarding the Rift is that the AIDS Healthcare Foundation has come out against PrEP, which is pre-exposure prophylaxis. And for those who are watching that may not know, PrEP allows someone who is HIV negative, who feels like they might end up participating in higher risk sexual behavior, they can start taking a daily pill, which is actually called Truvada. And when they take that pill as prescribed by a doctor, generally within about 2 weeks, it renders them almost scientifically incapable of being infected with HIV. And there's a huge belief among the leadership in the fight against HIV and AIDS that PrEP is a very important tool in ending the HIV and AIDS epidemic. And the consensus among most HIV AIDS organizations is that PrEP is a good thing, but AIDS Healthcare Foundation, from all of my understanding, opposes it. Have I articulated that from your perspective accurately?
Yes, and I believe they do allow some of their patients to be prescribed it now, I believe, but it's something that they are very, very, you know, they've been pressured to do it, so it's not something that they do willingly. People that I know that go to them for care, you know, that are negative and that have tried to get PrEP are constantly told that they shouldn't be on it, that they should be worried about the side effects, that it's going to result in, you know, super diseases and stuff. So, I mean, you know, even though they are prescribing it to some people, it's been at a pressure from the community.
Okay. So what I wanted to do is I basically wanted to provide the listeners with a context in terms of HIV activists, sort of how they meet, what they're doing, how they come together, who they're wanting to talk about, and what some of the oppositions and opposing views and conflicts might be in the environment. With that said, in this context, HIV AIDS activists met with Bernie Sanders, and what happened is after that meeting, the Sanders campaign issued a press release that was misleading, and very upsetting to those that were present at the meeting. But before we get into the press release, they've issued a transcript, the activists that were there, since Thomas was on the show earlier in the week, have issued a transcript about the meeting. The whole transcript has been published. It's a published widely available. But if you go to promohomo.tv and you find this particular blog about Thomas Davis and Bernie Sanders, and you go to the bottom of that blog, there's a link to the actual Word document. So you can find the document at promohomo.tv. So Thomas, you, of course, were at the meeting, but now you've had a chance to kind of read the meeting again. And for those that weren't there and haven't read the transcripts, what do you believe were the key points that the activists made in the meeting that stand out for you?
That there are more issues around HIV than the issues around meds. There's more to HIV than drug pricing. What's basically the mess. There were so many other things that we covered and talked about that, you know, we were just trying to shed light and make sure that, you know, in the Sanders campaign, you know, that basically the next president is informed about what they're talking about, and that when they're talking about an issue, they see the big picture, not just a little part of it.
Now, did Senator Sanders, did he say anything? What did he say that led you to believe that he was on your side, that he was someone?
Did he say anything in the meeting that he said? He was very engaged in the conversation. He really had questions. When I spoke after, he thanked me and he shook my hand and he told me I did a good job, and you know, he thanked me for my time and sharing my story and everything. So really, just in his behavior, you know, and I still believe, you know, that he genuinely does care about this issue, and he did want to understand power.
Okay, So a variety of activists met with Bernie Sanders, and you all had this meeting. And then shortly thereafter, what happened?
Well, then after, basically, the campaign released a press release that was very misleading, making it sound like the meeting that we had was about the ballot initiative that AIDS Healthcare Foundation is backing. Because, you know, the Sanders campaign, they are, you know, basically partnered with them on that and are embedded with them in the event. So after that press release was released, like any cause worth its salt, at this point, if a meeting that you had was misrepresented, any organization, any cause could call that individual out regardless of who it is. So we issued an open letter and sent it to the campaign, basically telling them that we were very concerned that we felt like our meeting had been used for Senator Sanders' own political agenda, and that we asked that they issue a release really stating the other things that we had. And in this, there were things that we said that you know, that he committed to creating an AIDS-free generation by, well, we encouraged him to go with 2030, but he went with 2020. Talk about the HIV criminalization laws that we brought up and how they need to be changed. Like, there were a few things that we had that we encouraged him to bring up. After that, the campaign lashed back out at one of the individuals that really did a lot of the groundwork at the beginning of the epidemic with ACT UP, that was Peter Staley, and they lashed out at him saying that, you know, he was biased for receiving money from Gilead, which he doesn't. And it just kind of spiraled into something really, really, really bad. And, you know, people saw that, you know, that the campaign kind of used the meeting to spin their own agenda. We were told by the campaign manager that basically they talked about the issues that they felt were important, so everything else, I guess, was deemed unimportant. But yeah, overall, it was just misrepresented, and when we tried to call the campaign out, we were met with backlash instead of an apology.
So they resisted your effort to clarify what the activists had actually spoke about, you among them.
Yeah, and they still have not. They still have not issued a clarification. Still to this day, we issued our own press release, but they have not commented.
That is a bit odd, isn't it?
I would say it is disappointing. But considering the history of the HIV epidemic in politics, I wouldn't say it's surprising or necessarily odd. It's just unfortunate that things like this still happen.
May I ask a personal question? Well, it's not that personal. It's I just don't remember the information, and I know that you share it. How old are you?
I am 24. I just turned 24 in April.
And what year were you born in?
92.
Okay, so I imagine, and I just have to confess that I haven't watched How to Survive a Plague yet. It's an award-winning documentary about the key activist, Peter Staley, among them, who were involved in with ACT UP and in really turning the country around in a creative and radical way in the fight against HIV and AIDS. But as a young HIV positive, and you share your status, so I'm not outing you as someone who's positive.
Yeah, not at all.
But as a young HIV positive man of color, who's in your fairly early 20s, when you see this movie about what even happened around this before you were born, when you saw that movie and you sort of got more deeply connected to not only the roots of the disease, but the roots of the activism, what was your response?
I was wondering why the hell I hadn't seen this before. It really pulled a lot of how we handle the epidemic currently into perspective, and it really deepened my understanding. I finally understand why, you know, the generations above me, you know, call my generation complacent, and it all makes sense. And, you know, I'm not saying that my generation is, but in comparison, you know, these were people that were getting arrested for with having die-ins in churches, people that were storming pharmaceutical companies and refusing to leave until they saw change, people that got beat, people that got pushed around, people that threw the ashes of their loved ones on the White House lawn, like all these things. So, you know, when you look at the that comparison, people, you know, that was activism in the 80s and 90s. And then you look at it now, like with the new activists especially, it's no wonder that people think we're complacent, because we have those two completely different comparisons, and it's not entirely fair, but it pulled it all into perspective for me. You know, and it also made me realize that there are a lot of allies that we've forgotten, and that we've and a lot of allyships that have been, you know, destroyed and haven't been, you know, reignited, and they should be. You know, there were so many women and lesbians that you know, really helped us. And I didn't mean to separate those two. I'm just gonna say that. But there were so many women that really helped at the beginning of this epidemic, that helped us die. That helped us die in peace. That helped run ACT UP. That would help make sure that things were being put to a vote. Like there was so much that was done. You know, people were calling out since the beginning that people of color needed to be at the table. People have been saying that women needed to be at the table since the beginning. And it really just, I realized that there is so much rhetoric that is still being thrown around because we haven't learned from the history. We didn't know that at one point people were against condoms, and people were saying that if you just push condoms on people that would result in everybody transmitting HIV eventually, or super disease, or STIs. And that's the same argument that's being used around PrEP. So it's like we're using the same arguments, you know, years and years and years later, because we haven't taught this history to the younger generations. You know, we don't grow up learning what happened.
Did you ever see the movie And the Band Played On?
No, but it's another one that I know that I need to see, and it's been added to my list. I have a list that's building up.
I think that you will be riveted by the film, especially decades later as a young person living with HIV. I haven't talked about it in this episode because it's widely known, but I'm living with HIV. As a matter of fact, my studio is in my apartment, which is part of a complex associated with Desert AIDS Project, of which I am a grateful client. And so I think it's very important for as many of us as possible to speak out as openly HIV-positive people to help fight stigma and to give name, faces, and circumstances to the stories and to the issue. And I'm wondering, Thomas, if you would recount for us when you decided, take us through when you learned that you were HIV-positive, what your initial reaction was, and what led you to actually go public with your status?
Well, when that happened, you know, when I was told that I was positive, I just, like, because the girl that was the tester, it was her first day, like, doing the test, actually, and they told me that beforehand, and she had, you know, someone that was training her. So for me, I just kind of stared at her, and the first thought in my head was just like, okay, she must have made a mistake. But then I was like, no, this isn't a mistake, clearly. So, I mean, I left that day just, you know, after I set up my appointment that next week. And, you know, I didn't really, I feel like I've said this so many times, but I didn't really react at first. I just kind of was like, okay, well, what do I do now? You know, and as the year went on and I started to learn more about HIV, I realized, I was like, oh, okay, well, I'm healthy, so there's nothing to freak out about. I finished school, I got my degree. And then, you know, I started looking around for other people that were HIV positive. The only people that I saw were usually older gay white men. I didn't see anyone that was black, so I looked to see if that was just, you know, because there aren't a whole lot of us, and I realized that they're actually... We make up the most newly diagnosed cases every year. So I guess I decided that if this was an issue, I didn't understand why people weren't talking about it. So I would talk about it in hopes that others would feel that it was okay and come out and start talking about it, so that I guess I just didn't want to be alone. So I was hoping that people would follow suit and, you know, just follow my lead and you know, just live openly.
And what sort of response did you get from friends and family when you shared your status with them?
Everyone was extremely supportive. Everyone's been supportive, from my family to my friends to my workplace. You know, it's been really great. And, you know, as I started to come out and be outspoken about it, different friends that were already involved in the field and in the community, you know, would basically give me opportunities to either go to conferences or to, you know, talk about, share my story in videos, and, or they would share my content. So after that, it was really awesome that I was extremely supported, and people definitely provided me opportunities to continue doing the work.
While you've been talking, I've been showing the viewers, I've been taking them on a tour of your profile pictures on Facebook, so they could actually see you while they were talking to you. And if I were looking at the photos, one of the things that would have stood out to me is that you're also a dancer. And I'd love for you to share a little bit about that aspect of who you are.
Mm-hmm. I actually went to school for dance. I went to AMDA College and Conservatory of the Arts and got my bachelor's in performing arts dance theater. So I got a degree in everything. After I graduated, I danced for the W.E.L. and Dance Academy for like a summer, and then I started dancing for the Lula Washington Dance Theater, and they are a professional modern dance company. I danced with them for 2 seasons, and yeah, that really was my passion. When I first started doing activism, it was kind of balancing my time between, you know, going to conferences and traveling and being back and dancing with the company. So it was an amazing 2 seasons. I am currently taking a break now because I am now working at the Los Angeles LGBT Center. But they're an amazing company, and they've always been so supportive of the work that I do, and have really helped me bring my activism to dance, and really have tried to really always encourage me to mesh the two.
My friend and viewer, Buzz, says, "Bravo to Thomas. I've been living with HIV for 31 years now and applaud his efforts." And Rich and Dennis and David and Clifton and Anderson are all watching. One of the things, and actually, Buzz has to go. He has appointments. But one of the activists that I recently friended, and because he's a recent friend of mine, I cannot cite his name, but I love looking at what he writes. And it led me to sort of the next 2 questions that I want to ask you. What would you like to say to other young MSM of color? Now, MSM, for those who do not know, stands for men who have sex with men. One of the reasons that they use that term is that there are lots of men who have sex with men that don't relate to the term gay or bisexual. They actually, many men who have sex with men, if you get into those other labels, would consider themselves heterosexual, actually. So in terms of trying to identify and convey health education campaigns, the term MSM has evolved out of it. And so if you could talk to other young MSM of color, what messages do you most want to convey?
The thing that I focus on when I, you know, talk to other people in my community is that this is not somebody else's issue. This is our issue. That HIV can happen and is happening to anyone. And that this is not something that's going to end without everybody's support and help. This is not something that you can leave for somebody else to take care of. And it doesn't mean that you are responsible for it being here. Like, no, none of us are responsible for HIV being here, but we're dealing with it. So it has to be a collective effort to eradicate it. It can't just be one group of people that is fighting this. We all have to unite together, regardless of if you identify as gay or straight or bi or whatever, that this is something that affects everybody. And, you know, when you try to distance yourself from it and act like it's not your issue, you're actually putting yourself more at risk.
Okay, so the other question that I wanted to ask, and this relates to the activism that I just mentioned, is I guess I want to acknowledge, at least from my own experience, that, and I hope that I'm very well into my own educational curve, but I think that white guys, white people like me, think that we know what a person of color is going through, but in many ways we're clueless. And the activist that I'm referring to is a man of color, and I was thinking that if I were to have him on my show, the theme would be what us white folks really need to hear. So I would like you to tell me what you think us white folks really need to hear. What do you think is missing among, let's get a little bit more specific, what do you think is missing among the gay white male community in terms of their understanding and approach to who you are and what you're facing?
I think, this is funny, this is actually something that I deal with quite regularly. For me, I think the thing is when I try to explain or share, I guess I would say that, but when I try to share my experience as a person of color living with HIV, I think people need to realize that that is something that they will never truly and fully understand, and you can empathize with it as much as it can, as much as you want, and you will be able to empathize with it, but it's really not something that you will ever experience, and that's okay. There is nothing wrong with knowing and admitting that this is an experience that you don't know anything about and that you won't ever have to experience. And I think it's just respecting that and realizing that sometimes your commentary isn't needed, that it's sometimes you need to just keep that in your head and you need to meditate on it for a while. A lot of the time when I share my experience, people try to be like, oh, no, I know what it's like because of this, so I can relate to you. And it's like, no, you can't. Like, I'm sorry, like, you can't. It's not the same thing. It'd be like somebody that's HIV negative thinks they can relate and they know exactly what it feels like to somebody that's positive. I mean, when in reality, you don't. And you can empathize with it. You can be exposed to it. You can be knowledgeable for it. You can be an ally. You can be, everything. But at the end of the day, you aren't going to understand that struggle, and that is totally fine, but you need to be aware of it and just be and just realize that that we are both privileged in this aspect. There is privilege in being black, and there is privilege in being white. So it's just recognizing what kind that you have and how it fits into the grand scheme of.
What are the differences? I think some of the answers to this question are obvious because of systemic racism and all of the impact that has. But is there a way to describe, do you have a way of articulating the differences between what you face as an African-American man living with HIV? All right, let's get a little bit more specific. Let's just say that there's a white young HIV positive activist who's out there doing the same work that you are.
Mm-hmm.
Are there different challenges that you would face in the work that you're doing than that person would be facing specifically because of white privilege?
I think one of the things that I face a lot, and that other young men that are doing the work that I do that are of color face, is that a lot of the time when we go to these spaces and we share our story or something like that, we're kind of lumped in all together, and we're made to speak for an entire community that is extremely diverse. The black community is so diverse. There are so many different people in it, but a lot of the time, because there aren't a whole lot of us speaking out, we are kind of made spokespeople or posters for the whole community when we don't necessarily reflect the community in its entirety. I mean, I don't think any of us do. And even that, a lot of the times when we go into there, it's it's not so much about, it's just about getting somebody that's black to share their story. It's about getting somebody that's black and quote unquote articulate, you know, which is just a way of saying that, you know, you don't talk like you're a Negro. You know, so, I mean, there's different things like that. I mean, it's so much to unpack, and I could talk for hours and hours and hours about it. But even just the two communities, you know, the way the white community handles HIV is very different from the way the black community handles HIV. I mean, in the black community, we have a history of medical mistrust from the AIDS experiments. You know, people experimenting with syphilis on us and all this crazy stuff, and even just getting back to racism. I mean, there are all these reasons why, you know, the black community does not trust the medical community, different reasons why we don't talk about HIV, you know, different reasons. There's the foundations for both communities were built on very differently and in very different places. So a lot of the times, you know, as a black man, I'm navigating through things that I don't necessarily understand. You know, I don't necessarily understand why, you know, there can be so much stigma from the black community around HIV. You know, and it's something that I had to start to figure out, you know, that you know, I've come to understand more. But at first, you know, it didn't make any sense to me. So it was odd. It was, you know, I'd look at the two communities and be like, wait, why do we handle this so differently than they handle it? It didn't make sense to me. But once you start to break down all those little things and all these things that have happened in the past and how they influence our present, it starts to make more sense. Sorry, go ahead.
No, well, I was going to say, I want you to finish your point because I'm going to segue, and I don't want to leave this topic until you feel like you've actually finished your point.
Okay, for sure. I mean, you know, it's like, if I could describe it, you know, when, as gay men, you know, we've all been in spaces where people are kind of pushing our buttons and saying little homophobic things, or the way they go about, you know, acting around you is just different, and you know it's because you're gay. Now, imagine that, but because you're black. I mean, it's the same thing. But then it's on top of having that because you're gay. It's having it because you're black. It's having people, you know, follow you around the store. It's having people that, you know, even when you know, when they know and see you at your workplace, still having to show the security guard your ID when you come here. I mean, it's all these little things, and these little occurrences don't seem that big, you know, when you just pull them out singularly, but when you add them all together and when you put together what these are called microaggressions, and you look at the amount that people have to deal with every day, I mean, it takes a toll on people, you know, and it turns from something that is very small into actually a very serious problem, because when you look at every single occurrence that happens that's like that, it can be very overwhelming, and it affects communities differently.
One of the things that I wanted to ask you about, and thank you so much for being here, we started off the conversation talking about the HIV/AIDS activists who were meeting with Bernie Sanders and how that the result of that meeting got twisted. I do want to say that HIV/AIDS activists also met with Hillary Clinton, and Hillary Clinton actually made in many ways her own significant gap. So I'm not presenting this information as someone who's pro-Hillary or pro-Bernie, although I do definitely have my own take on which candidate that I support, and it's not a secret. My purpose for exploring this issue is that we have a bunch of leading HIV activists that that their sort of expression of what was important to them got hijacked, and I wanted to call an issue to it. But Thomas, since I have you on the air and you're so I'm going to say you're so articulate, that has nothing to do with my surprise that a young man of color is articulate. But I want to talk to anyone thoroughly that has the ability to express themselves. And so, at any rate, is that something I should never say to a person of color? You're articulate. If I would say it to
I'm not going to make a blanket statement with everybody, because, you know, I'm not going to say that you can never say that. But I guess I should clarify that in the context that I was describing, I was talking about when a lot of times, you know, black men living with HIV are brought into spaces that were that are basically known for not being very diverse, and it's under that reasoning. So it's under the reasoning that, oh, we're reaching out to you because you're articulate and because you're doing this. So you know, I'm not offended by anybody saying that. Like, if you're really genuinely saying that, then okay. But if it's you know, an underhanded, backhanded thing that you're just saying, oh my gosh, you talk good for a black person, you know, there's definitely a difference between that. So I'm not saying that you should never say that to somebody, but it's just really looking at, you know, what you're really saying. And if you're really saying that the person is really articulate and you really mean it, then okay, cool. But if you're saying something else under it, then that's something to look into. But no, I wasn't offended by that. Don't worry.
Well, good, because I certainly didn't mean it that way. One of the things I wanted to ask you is that, so you've definitely, I imagine that you have used smartphone apps to meet other guys?
Yes.
Okay, so I want you to speak to the racism, the homophobia, and the stigma directed at people living with HIV in that environment. Talk about how those things manifest themselves in that environment.
For me, I mean, I don't have Jack or Grindr anymore because I'm in a relationship, but when I was on it, since the beginning, I've been very open about my status. I put it straight out there, and, you know, it's funny, you know, I would get so many people that look at my profile, and only a good handful of them would reach out to me, but it seems to be that, I don't think people are that afraid of being with somebody that's HIV positive. I just think that, that if they are going to be with somebody that's HIV positive, there needs to be something that they feel compensates for it. One of the things that I heard the most was that people couldn't tell that I hate HIV by looking at me, or that I didn't care because I was quote unquote sexy anyway. So for me, it seemed to be that people were okay with me being HIV positive because I was attractive enough to overpower that, I guess. I don't know if that makes a whole lot of sense, but it seemed to be that people didn't want to be with somebody that it was kind of a turn on for them, because they're like, oh my gosh, you're HIV positive, I never would have known, as opposed to somebody, you know, if I was probably obese, and you know, if I looked different or something like that, or if there was you know, if my skin was bad, or if I wasn't muscular, or maybe, you know, a bunch of other things, or if I was more feminine, you know, I don't think they would have the same reaction to me, which is very unfortunate. But I feel like one of the reasons why, you know, for me in particular, that people didn't really seem to care so much about my status was just because I was attractive enough to quote-unquote pass.
Well, that's fascinating. I wasn't expecting that particular answer. What do you think about when people say, on those applications said, drug and disease-free, seeking same, or I'm clean? What do you think about statements like that?
I think that they don't mean a whole lot to me, because even people that say that have I'm clean, UB2, or DDF on their profile, those people would still reach out to me all the time. So I think a lot of the time people put that up as a defense, maybe because they're hiding something of their own, maybe because they just haven't been exposed to somebody that is HIV positive. They think that it looks a certain way. They think that it's somebody that is disgusting or ugly. Like, I'm not exactly sure what it is, but to me, those don't really seem to hold a whole lot of merit, because at the end of the day, I still had people that were saying negative UB2, hit me up, still trying to meet up, that I did meet up with. And, so, I mean, to me, it seems to just be a facade that they throw up.
Well, I appreciate everything that you've shared about today. Is there anything that you would like to address that you feel passionate about that maybe we haven't touched upon?
Yes. I mean, we kind of touched upon this, but I guess I'll just kind of sum all this up. You know, this whole experience with Bernie Sanders, and, you know, even like looking at the notes, I wasn't in on the Hillary Clinton meeting, but looking at those notes as well, overall, I think that it's great that HIV has become a subject in the political race. I think it's something that needs to continue, and people need to not let up and just let people gloss over this. Overall, this whole situation was misrepresented, and you know, I think people need to be held accountable for it, regardless of who you support. I think you should hold your candidate accountable for representing things accurately, regardless of who you support. And just that overall, I've learned so much about the history throughout this past 2 weeks. That, you know, even working in this field for 3 years, I consider myself pretty knowledgeable, realizing that there is so much more that I have to learn. And, you know, I would encourage those that have been doing this work since the beginning, or that are long-term survivors, that have seen this epidemic morph the way it has, to reach out to people that are younger than you. Realize that if you aren't telling this story and these stories to people, and if you aren't teaching the people that are young and that are close to you or that are in your network, other people probably aren't either, and that it's something that needs to happen, just like with the civil rights movement and just like with Roots being on TV now, again. It's important for generations to understand their history. You know, like if I was a Black Lives Matter activist, I can't go to a rally for Black Lives Matter and be angry about, you know, how the devastation of Black lives if I don't understand the African diaspora, where we came from, what we dealt with in slavery, what the civil rights movement was involved with, who was the people that were leading it. Like, you know, you have to understand your history. And we aren't going to get it in school. We aren't going to get it from our health classes. We aren't going to get it from our parents. So those that were there, I feel, have a duty to reach out to the generations below you and to teach them. And yes, we live in a digital generation where people can go on Google and they can do this. But guess what? If we don't reach out and tell them that this is something we need to worry about, we ain't going to worry about it. So I think it's an opportunity for the generation to build a bridge and to unite.
I think that's very well said. You know what the downside is for me working with someone your age?
Our mouths.
No, it's in my face that I'm old enough to be your father.
Well, my father is like
reminds me, I'm in a completely different generation. You know, when I see someone and I ask them how old they are and they're my age, I think to myself, either I am well preserved or in great denial. No, but I'm actually joking. The fact of the matter is, I think getting older is a privilege. I think that there is great wisdom among youth. I think that the huge key through all of our problems and challenges is to be loving, respectful, and communicative with one another. I guess I would like to segue into sort of a hotter topic. I want to say hello to Ernesto, who's watching. I believe that Ernesto is a Bernie Sanders supporter. I do know from his comments he's not a Hillary supporter, so I want to just acknowledge that there's a platform for everyone on this show, and if you ever think that there's a topic that needs to be addressed and you want to help articulate that topic on my show, please reach out to me at promohomo.tv. There's contact information. But when you went into this meeting with Bernie Sanders, you really were on the fence among, I guess you were still deciding between Hillary and Bernie.
Absolutely.
Was that true at that time, and have you made a decision?
For me, yeah. I mean, at the beginning of this election, I mean, of this the race, I was so on Bernie's side. I was all about him, and just throughout the process, and seeing him debate and realizing that there weren't exactly a whole lot of plans that he could articulate, you know, I fell into the middle, and I really wasn't sure who I wanted to support. Just because, you know, I find things that are very problematic with Hillary, and I find things that are very problematic with Bernie. You know, I have a hard time believing that the political revolution is going to be led by a cisgendered white Jewish man, you know, 70-year-old or 60-year-old, however old he is, you know, like, you know, that those are my own issues. But you know, I went into this meeting really hoping that, you know, I was really rooting for him. I was like, okay, you know, I hope that this goes well. I hope it's handled well. I hope he is a champion for this, because if he is, I really felt like that could reignite my support for him. The meeting was great. I felt like he really does care about these issues, but how his campaign has handled it, and the fact that he hasn't addressed it, has been extremely disappointing to me. And I feel like, you know, just overall, I feel like if there is somebody that believes in, you know, in healthcare for everybody, if people are in this field and are working with HIV, and if it's something that you support, I don't care which candidate it is, really, but you need to vote, because otherwise we can lose it. We can lose all the work that we've been doing, and it isn't about you being throwing a tantrum and being like, well, my candidate didn't get elected, so I'm not going to do nothing. I mean, like let's be adults and realize that this is a bigger issue than your candidate not getting a pick. You know, overall, I mean, I right now I am kind of leaning towards Hillary still a little more, and it's kind of more like it's not so much I'm with her. It's more like I guess I'm with her. So just wait for something to handle. I mean, it's disappointing. So I find it very odd that, you know, a campaign that is so set on, you know, tearing down Pharma Bro is basically partnering with an organization that, if you were to compare any organization in the HFU to Pharma Bro, it would be them. You know, it just seems to be that Bernie did not do his research. In my opinion, I do not think that Bernie really did his research on which organization to partner up with, on what the organization was doing. That's problematic to me. Regardless of what issue that you are speaking about, you know what you're talking about, and it was very clear that there is a lot that he needs to learn. So for me, as somebody that has dedicated his life to doing this work, I morally can't really support Bernie Sanders if he's in bed with AHS. Like, just with me, I don't support anything that really they do. So the fact that a candidate is you know, in bed with them, it's very hard to, because my own morals uphold it. You know, I can't support an organization that is against PrEP. I mean, it makes no sense. Being a black gay man that is living with HIV, I was going to AHF for the first 2 years that I was positive, and I've since left them. I am upset as to why I didn't learn about PrEP and why I wasn't told that PrEP was something that I should be on, and the fact that they are continuing to advocate people not being on it and that they don't want people on it, it pulls morality completely into question for me, and it's very upsetting, and it sucks that, you know, that I have to make a choice based on that. But overall, you know, I can't morally support, you know, somebody that is endorsing that company. It don't seem right.
Okay, well, I really want to thank you for being on the show today. I'm glad we made it through the show and that we didn't get disconnected. And I've been checking, and the live feed has been going out consistently on Facebook and on Blog Talk Radio. Do you have a final comment?
A final comment. I would just say that at the end of the day, everybody needs to realize that we are in this together, that it doesn't matter whether you're HIV positive, whether you're HIV negative, whether you're gay, straight, black, white, whether you're for Hillary or whether you're for Bernie. All of us need to get out there, and we need to vote for the person that is going to keep what we have, because that's gonna continue on the progress that we have made. So basically, anybody but Trump. You know, and this is not about, we don't need to be divided anymore. That it's not going to help us. That's going to be us shooting ourselves in the foot if we stay divided on this. So regardless of how you feel, I just encourage people to unite at the end of the day. You know, up until the primary and up until the candidate is elected, fine, go at it. Argue, yell at each other, do whatever you want. But at the end of the day, we need to come together.
I love it. You know, I'm going to leave the last word to someone that I believe is a friend of yours. Well, sort of. I'm not going to literally leave it as the last word, but I'm going to share with a common sentiment with you that your friend Deanna Jones is saying here in the chat. Keep it up, Thomas Davis. Love you always. Keep fighting for your cause.
I love her. She's great.
Well, I'm honored to call you friend, and I know the last time you were in my neck of the woods in Palm Springs that you were very busy and scantily clad. I guess we should explain why you were in Palm Springs, very busy and scantily clad, because I think we would leave everyone with a huge dose of curiosity. What did you do on your last trip to Palm Springs?
I was a spokesmodel for the Get Tested Coachella for Black Chino Oasis, and basically what we do, they put us in Speedos and we entice people to get tested, pretty much.
Get Tested, CoachellaValley.org, a great research, a resource and a fantastic model. It's actually being looked at and celebrated by the White House in terms of their response to the HIV/AIDS epidemic. Well, thank you, Thomas, and I look forward to seeing you in the real world at some point, and I really appreciate you taking the time to be on the show today.
Thank you very much. Thank you for asking me.
You're welcome. You're going to be. I'm going to wrap up the show now. If you want to listen, you can stay on. But Thomas, do you have any Twitter or social networking information that you want to give out?
Yes. You can find me on Facebook at Thomas Davis, or you can follow my page at Positively Thomas. Positively is spelled with a Z. Or you can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Tommy's a Dancer. That's TOMMYSADANCER. Tommy's a Dancer. Onward.
Okay. Thank you so much once again.
Thank you.
And until next time, everybody, I'm Nicholas.
For all of our upcoming programs, social media links, and a link to all of our advertisers, visit promohomo.tv. Until next time, I'm Nicholas Snow.
So I just wrapped up the Facebook Live feed, and now I'm going to end the Blog Talk Radio feed, but I really appreciate your time, Thomas, and I hope you enjoy the rest of your week. Bye-bye.